Charlie. You have got to control this thing because it's a bad thing. You understand me? A bad thing.
Welcome to the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, Firestarter Retrospective Series.
I'm a little nervous about this, Andy McGee.
Join Garrett.
Don't you ever bathe, weirdo?
Matt.
Micro hemorrhages, his brain bleeds when he uses his power.
And Adam.
I want to do that again!
As they review all of the adaptations of author Stephen King's 1980 novel.
Honest to gosh, there's nothing going on here except...
We know what's going on.
Please don't make me do anything!
And keep coming back, as periodically the boys will continue to review each Stephen King adaptation in publication order.
Is this experiment being done by the shop?
No. Absolutely not.
So heat up, percolated media listeners.
Come on, I want to see you, son of a bitch!
The Three Men in a Retrospective Firestarter series begins now.
So, if we may begin the injections now, please.
Firestarter, 2022, released May 13th, 2022. Budget on this was $12 million. Box office has a worldwide take of $15 million. And this is directed by Keith Thomas. All right. Oh. Well, Keith Thomas, interesting you said that, Matt. A few years before this, he did a movie called The Vigil. To prepare for this podcast, I actually watched The Vigil. And you know what? If I had seen this movie in 2019 when this movie had come out, it would have probably been in my, at least an honorable mention as my top five film of that year. It is great. There's basically this ritual amongst the Jewish community of watching a dead body for 5 days before it actually gets buried. And there's a guy who gets assigned to that, and needless to say, he sees things that he was not expecting to see. It's very well done. Jump scares are very well set up, and I can definitely see Jason Blum seeing that and saying, you know what? I need to bring him on to my parade of directors because I have properties to do. And here we are with Firestarter in 2022, 3 years after Dr. Sleep. Matt, is it safe to say they are really running the well dry here, aren't they?
Well, to a point, because I always say if you're going to remake something that didn't get it right. And having not read the book, there was a lot that I found wrong with the original Firestarter. So I think a remake for this was warranted. You know, it's not like remaking Carrie, where I'm like, why? The De Palma movie got almost everything right. And I understand updating it for modern audiences, because bullying was a lot different in 2013 versus 76. And they also waited 40 years. Now, there is a movie in between, but I guess they wiped it off the face of the planet because none of us could find it. So the DSI must have found rekindled and burned every copy alive. But look, 40 years is more than enough time. I mean, we had... two Planet of the Apes reboots in the span of a decade. This was justified, even if I didn't have much excitement for it.
Yeah, and I can understand actually doing this, if only because this is the era of King that is most fondly remembered, right? That first decade or so of his writing is what really put him on the map. And I kind of compare it to like the golden age of WWF with Hogan running things as he was going through opponents left and right in the 80s and the early 90s. It's the era that is most fondly remembered of his work. And, you know, we haven't gotten to It yet. We haven't gotten to Cujo yet. We haven't gotten to a lot of those films that are so fondly remembered. So I do feel that this is something that I could see updating for a modern audience. Adam, as somebody who was not a big fan of that first movie, as me and Matt also are not, were you at least looking forward to an updating of maybe an improvement of that last film?
I think that it stood that it could be updated. I mean, come on, the little girl from the first one is now a middle-aged TV talk show host. Sorry, that's demeaning. I love Drew Barrymore. She's done so much. I just can't believe I see her on daytime TV. I think the movie can do a lot of things better. I think it is Rainbird. I think it's prime for updating. But at the same time, I am sick and tired of the same five properties from Stephen King. So, yes, to your point, this is the thing is, though, this is the stuff around that time that he was known for that was really popped him big. So IP name recognition means a lot. But Jesus Christ, they keep going to the same few wells. And it's just, it's got like, what, 483 books? Take another one.
Well, that's the thing, is that when we get to the 90s novels and the early 2000s novels, none of those are really as fondly remembered as this era. Not
but
many.
I do think Jason, I guess I could say Jason Blum, who's kind of picked properties and IPs that need rebooted. He's been choosy. He's been picky. And I guess this was his first one from King, right? But just a few years before, we got his son. So he'd worked with Blum.
Yes. And he'd also done Halloween by this time as well. So he has gobbled up these properties and done what he's done with them. And look, we have a writer of one of those Halloweens on this project. So I do think Blum has his own circle of people that he runs to. We'll be discussing Black Phone 2 later on this year. So Matt, he does take these properties and kind of runs with them, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does. But sometimes he falls before he gets out of the starting gate.
For sure.
Because, well, we'll talk about Halloween in 10 years.
Yeah. Let's discuss this one. This was a movie that was actually, before it even became a movie, started off as a TV project. This was going to be a TV series called The Shop. It was being developed in 2014. And then that kind of fell by the wayside. And so at this point, Blumhouse picked up the property and they had hired another director before Keith Thomas, but that director left the project. Keith Thomas was brought on board and it wasn't long before we started seeing trailers for it. And Matt, were you at all at least interested or curious as to if Jason Blum could do something different with this property?
Curious, yes. Anticipating, no. Because I think there is untapped potential in this story based on what the first one did. But I will say, just because Blumhouse had its name on it didn't give me a ringing endorsement, because I find a lot of their output to be hit or miss. Sometimes you get something like The Invisible Man, which is great, and then other times they'll do
Wolfman
sequels to their original movies, like Sinister 2, I thought was just dog shit. So I never know what I'm going to get.
I agree with that. When he hits, he hits. De Laurentiis was the same way, right? And we still have the De Laurentiis name on this. In fact, a producer of this was De Laurentiis' widow, and this was the last thing she produced before she died. So this is the lasting thing on her resume. Scott Toombs, who had done Halloween Kills, he is on as a screenwriter here. Matt, as a non-fan of that Blumhouse Halloween era, Scott Toombs doesn't really inspire any hope, nor does Akiva Goldsman, who's also on as a producer here.
Yeah, well, thank God that dipshit didn't direct this as originally intended, because letter to Hollywood, if you have a genre project and Akiva Goldsman is attached to it, take that script and burn it, because that man, ultimate peaks and valleys, a couple really good things, and then 12 things you could argue are the worst thing ever made by a human being. I was not happy with Goldsman, because by this point, Star Trek had beaten me down. Between Discovery and the first two seasons of Picard, I wanted nothing to do with that son of a bitch.
Oh, was he on those?
Oh, yeah. He was a big part of Discovery, and more so Picard season one. I think season two was a different showrunner. Not that it mattered, because they both sucked balls.
All right. So does this movie suck balls? Let's find out. We open up the Universal logo as well as the good old Blumhouse logo. And we have to mention, we talked about a couple weeks ago how John Carpenter was shut out of directing Firestarter after his movie The Thing bombed. Here, he's doing the score. And you know what? I found this score to be pretty much equal to the Tambourine Dream score. When we did the first Firestarter, I found this score to be pretty underwhelming. A couple tracks I remember hearing right before the movie had come out, I was a little anxious. I thought I was going to hear something great, but I don't know. I was pretty let down by this. Adam, how do you feel about the John Carpenter score?
I feel like he had a score that he put to it. I almost don't feel like he scored this film, if that makes sense. I mean, it's a score. I'll say it's passable. You know, it's not bad. It's a fine score. I mean, maybe a little better than what we got before. Like, it's okay. But John Carpenter does amazing scores, and this isn't amazing. But to lead off this, I had no idea this was a Blumhouse film. So to start this film, seeing Blumhouse and seeing John, you know, score by John Carpenter, I was excited to start this film, because those were two things that I was not ready for. And to Matt's point, yes, Blumhouse can be very hit and miss, but I'm always going to give them a shot where some other ones I might not. So I was at least like, shit, this movie's got me, has at least got a little bit of a hook into me, more than I was thinking.
Yeah, and people who are less inclined to dig into the credits as we are, they would see the John Carpenter's name on this and say, oh, wow, he's attached to this? I might have to see this. So I do think that was a draw. And plus, I do think Blumhouse was playing off the fact that Carpenter was kicked off that first film and to bring him on and be associated with Firestarter in a different way. And Carpenter had also worked with Blumhouse on those Halloween films. So I definitely think that all came to play.
The only fire that was started was the one that he used to light the joint he smoked before he went ahead and did this score. Because to me, it's white noise. I mean, look, it's not the worst thing in the world. But, I mean, I guess it's better than the alternative, like Ghost of Mars, where you got frickin' Anthrax to do the music instead. I guess it's better than that.
We start off much like we started the 2013 Carrie remake, except this one is a little after the birth of our title character. We're seeing things within Charlie's room being set ablaze as Andy walks in and sees her head set completely on fire. This, of course, is a dream as he wakes up right next to her.
Why is it that this effect never looks good of people being on fire? Because it's one of the reasons I'm scared of Fantastic Four is because they've never gotten the Human Torch right with how that looks. So, yeah, I mean, it doesn't help that this movie was made for the cost of a movie ticket nowadays, which is still considerably higher than it was in 1984, but be that as it may, is not enough to do a movie of this ilk, and it's so uninspired that they use the same goddamn poster in the marketing.
The exact poster. I thought the exact same thing. You swap out Drew Barrymore for this chick, it's the exact same thing. But before we get to her, let's talk about Zac Efron here.
Poor bastard.
Yeah, this is a guy who he went through the, what was that, Step Up? What was that series?
No, High School Musical. High School Musical.
High School Musical. Okay.
I will not let you besmirch Step Up. I will stand.
All right. I'm sorry. I think he's been trying desperately to escape that stigma. He did a horrible Ted Bundy movie for Netflix a few years ago. So bad. I find him to be just the same here. He's kind of walking through this role. I wish I could say something positive about Zac Efron because I've seen this go well. We talked about Robert Pattinson when he did The Batman. He's done a pretty good job of escaping the stigma that he came from. I don't think Zac Efron has, and this doesn't do him any favors.
I thought we weren't reviewing Sleepwalker until years from now. Because that's kind of what he's doing here. And I don't think it's his fault because I don't find this character to be that interesting in either version. But I feel like they cast him only because he's a name. And there's no one else in this cast outside of Kurtwood Smith that would intrigue me. So getting him in does interest me because he, you know, if you're looking for someone to play that prototypical dad, he's of the appropriate age now. And I always root for him, but God damn. I guess he changed his agent because clearly the guy who got him this was not the same one who got him the Iron Claw.
Weird. It's tough. Like it's almost strange seeing Zac Efron become dad age and in movies, you know, that he's the dad now. It's a weird thing to think of just because I can't stand High School Musical, but I know it. I remember it. Okay. I was at Disney when they did the parades. The
Wildcats. I was in school when those came out, if that makes you feel any better.
Christ.
No, it doesn't. But Zac Efron's kind of an enigma. Like, he has talent, and when it's brought out, he does damn good jobs. But it's almost like he really needs to make mortgage payments because he gets some random stuff where all he has to do is show up on set.
He had to pay the hospital bills for getting his face all fucked up.
Yeah,
that's true too. He's still paying those off based on some of his choices. He's a talented actor. But sometimes maybe he just really likes to work. Maybe he's got that thing where he's a shark that he thinks that if he stops swimming, he's going to die. He's not bad in this, but he doesn't elevate or bring something to it. Shit, he may be the best thing in this film, but I don't know if that's saying a lot. He's okay. But I'll say I was kind of glad to see him in here. You know, at least throughout this film, he's somebody that I can connect with and follow along to.
Yeah, Vicky, I don't like. Charlie, well, we'll talk about her in here in a bit. But you're right. If there's a likable presence, it is the Andy character. That's who we should be liking in this movie. And I hate to say this, but I prefer David Keith to Zac Efron in this. I don't like him in this. And like you, Matt, I just don't think that's his fault. I think the script really lets him down in a lot of ways where you had a chance to do something with this property that would have really enhanced your viewing of this character. And it just doesn't work, especially since you give this guy so many different things. Like, instead of him getting massive headaches, he bleeds from his eyes when he does the push, which was an interesting choice. But I guess they're trying to show the after effects.
Yeah, but I also find it hysterical that he uses the push right after a scene where someone gets blown out of a bathroom stall. Because, look, we've all had those nights where the push could have come in handy after spending 30 bucks, after 30 bucks at Chipotle. Freaking AIDS quilt wouldn't be enough to clean it.
All right, we discussed Zac Efron. Let's talk about our poster girl, Ryan Kira Armstrong. Now she's on Skeleton Crew, I guess. She's a part of that.
Still haven't seen it. No.
She was nominated for a Raspberry, and the Raspberry Awards took a major beating because she was like 12 years old when she did this, and they were like, isn't she too young? So they rescinded that.
Boo freakity who.
I know. But at the same time, I don't think it's her fault. I think she's okay. There's not enough pathos for me to judge her one way or the other. I just think she's just fine. I don't see the hatred that she got for this role. I really don't.
No, Lycus can be used as I talk about this film. She's okay. Drew Barrymore had a sweet little sensitivity to her, and that comes from E.T. almost. Mm-hmm. That's not here with this kid, so the sympathy is not there as much. But I do think it's unacceptable on the Razzie's part. That's just me. It's a mean-spirited award. At least give it to people who, not a first-time film for a child. But she's okay. I hope she was treated well on set, better than the script does her, better than the effects do her. You had to pick someone. You got to pick a kid that's going to be compared against Drew Barrymore in the 80s. That's kind of a shitty position to put anybody in.
You are absolutely right. And you hit on something I was going to get to later, but I'm going to go ahead and talk about it right now. You cast Drew Barrymore off the success of E.T. because of how cute she was in that movie. And you want what she does in that movie to scare you. Now, we talked about that when we did that film where they didn't pull that off very well. But that's what you're going for. When Blumhouse scooped this up, they had a chance to do something that would just make you terrified of this chick. And they can't do that. A, because they write this character wrong. And B, I don't think Armstrong is really up to the task. I just think she's just kind of there.
I used to be a lot more forgiving of kid actors. But I'm sorry, the bar has been raised by this time. Between the kids in It and Jacob Tremblay? There's no excuse for this. I feel bad because I don't think she's directed very well, which you could say about everybody in this, quite frankly. But yeah, was the Razzie too far? Yeah, but I don't think she's good. And there's also no excuse because we've gotten to the point where scary girls in horror movies, that's a cliche in and of itself. And you've got to do something different. And this really plays it safe. This feels way more sanitized than a movie in the 80s did, and that's surprising to me.
They really go for the family dynamic here, don't they? Instead of going for the horror of this, they're trying to make us really care by showing Charlie and Andy together, but to me, it just doesn't work.
I mean, the whole perspective is different, but there's never a moment I'm scared of her or, like, fearful of her, because I never feel like there's a point where she can lose control and turn into Dark Phoenix and blow up the Earth. Mm-hmm. Not that I want something of that scale, because it wouldn't befit, because I don't think they could afford an exterior shot of the moon off of Google Images with how fucking cheap this movie is. I can't believe this cost $12 million.
Using Photoshop effects, I can't either. So Andy's walking through the house some more as we see Charlie messing with a lighter, saying that she's had a bad dream. She tells Andy that something's changing, and she says that if she feels the bad thing coming, she can keep it from going out of control. At this point, the mom's alive, though, so we've changed that up.
I'm like, okay, so she's the Hulk?
It's so weird, right? When this movie was written, they pretty much just kept the names, and that's about it. There is nothing that I really recognize from these characters that I recognize from the 1984 movie. Now, I know that's the point when you adapt something, but you gotta do something different with these characters. We'll talk about Rainbird here in a bit, but Jesus Christ, so much has been changed that I don't even recognize this property anymore.
I mean, let me ask you this. How close is this to the book?
Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Everything has been changed here. There's one little thing that they do where he does the same thing from that first movie where he changes the look of a dollar bill into a $100 bill. Other than that, I really don't see any dynamic that they do that is even close to what we reviewed a couple weeks ago, which, as I mentioned, was pretty much as close as you can get to an adaptation without just calling it a retread of what's exactly on the page. So Andy offers some pancakes, which makes everyone happy. And then we cut to some footage of when Andy and Vicky initially got the Lot 6 testing as the credits roll. This is an interesting way to show the credits. I kind of like the way they do this, even though I think Efron looks a lot like Jared Leto here. I do find this opening credit sequence at least a little interesting.
Yeah, I thought this type of sequence was done really well in 2004. In 2022, what the hell are we doing? Put some Rob Zombie or some new metal over this kind of shit, because that's what this feels
like. No.
That's what this credit feels like. It's a choice, but this is not a modern credit sequence in any way. This is an early 2000s straight-to-video credit montage they're putting together. But at least it explains what's going on. And I kind of do like the changes for them getting the Lot 6 and what's going on with it.
I thought this was really revolutionary when Bill Bixby was sitting in that chair. I also don't like how they did some like plastic filter on Zac Efron's face to make him look younger.
Yes.
He looks like a wax dummy that you left in the sun too long.
We see Andy in a therapy session saying that he can make nicotine cravings go away.
Twitter's ink. Exactly what I thought.
Yeah, good call. We see his patient's eyes dilate as he tells her that she's done with smoking. So apparently he can push people to quit smoking.
Somewhere James Woods was going, where the fuck was this guy? Could have saved me a lot of heartache.
The patient pays him in cash and moves along. And of course, this is when we're introduced to the fact that doing this pushing makes him bleed from his eye.
Now, this is not from the book.
No. We then cut to a dissection of frogs. As Charlie tells the teacher, too much screen time causes health problems like insomnia in children.
All right. I hate this in movies. I've talked about this a lot. It's like Shyamalan, where all the kids talk like adults.
Yes. Because
she is written like she should be a teenager, when in reality she's like 6 or 7. Or how old is she supposed to be?
She's supposed to be that age, but in here she's 12.
Yeah. So she's written above her age, and all the adults talk like 10-year-olds. Villain included.
I'm going through that right now. I'm reading The Talisman by King and Peter Straub, and the kid in that is supposed to be 7, and he talks like a complete adult. It's really irritating me as I'm reading it. So all this causes one child to call her weird, and she starts thinking about roasting his things before the teacher asks her if she's okay. This reminded me a lot of Man of Steel when we saw Superman in school. Which
I was thinking of Day Carrie is what they should have called this.
Oh, God, so many Carrie flashbacks, especially given the age of Charlie in this.
I know I'm not going to care until we get on the run and we get the shot. So I want this to move along as quick as it can.
All right. So Charlie tells her mom that she doesn't want to go to school, and Vicky says that they just want her to live a normal life. She then tells her that she can't afford to get her a new phone, but Charlie talks about how some other kids just call her weird, as Vicky just says that she's not weird, she's special.
You're extraordinary, if you will.
Yeah.
This shit might as well take place in the freaking X-Men universe.
So many X-Men flashbacks as I was watching this. Vicky tells Charlie that she could never be scared of her. Andy and Vicky, they talk about what triggered this in Charlie, and Vicky says that she needs to be trained, which is their responsibility. So again, we are concentrating on the family dynamic here, right? They want to control Charlie. Andy says that she just needs to shove it down and keep it hidden. And then we get to every kid's worst nightmare, fucking dodgeball.
Nowadays, they don't even do this in schools. They've really kind of taken dodgeball out of the curriculum.
They have. The ginger takes her out, and as she feels her power coming on, she just runs away, and she tries cooling off by turning on all the water in the restrooms on cold. The teacher walks in and sees the bathroom's hot. She calls Charlie's name as the door bangs, and fire just explodes out of it. Again, none of this is in the book. This is all written for the film.
I mean, this is freaking Scott's laser beams going off in Apocalypse.
I thought you were going to say
it's the exact same thing.
I thought you were going to say Scott Howard in Teen Wolf when he goes in the bathroom and he has werewolf hands. But Charlie walks out and the teacher is scared to death at this point. We then see police show up at the school and Vicky promises it won't ever happen again. Principal tells them that she's not willing to risk having Charlie around as she hasn't been forthcoming about how she did it. We then cut to Vicky and Andy. They're arguing that if Charlie had learned to control her power, this wouldn't have happened. Charlie says that they need to move in the morning because now the shop is on to them, and he reveals that his eyes bleed when he pushes. Now,
I fucking burst out laughing when he said that.
I know.
I have the mind of a 15-year-old still, apparently. And I mean, look, we've all had those nights, but you don't say that to your wife.
Now, this is something that I want to go ahead and get into this right now. If you're going to remake this, make it a period piece from the 80s. Why would you do this in the all the paranoia that King preyed upon in that first book is gone here, because we don't have Men in Black anymore. We don't have these shops anymore. All the paranoia is gone. So you're not preying on anything in this except the fact that this girl causes fires. If you do it in 2022, we have cell phones around, we have everything else around. Matt, do you agree that maybe we should have done this as a period piece?
To a point, because I think of how much success they had with the first It movie taking place in the, mm-hmm. the time in. So I could see doing a similar period for that. I think that was the 80s. It's been a while since I've seen it. But yeah, I could see it taking place in that world and kind of maybe even saying it takes place in the same continuity, play into the whole thing of King's stuff being interconnected.
For sure.
But doing it in modern day, just look, in a world where school shootings happen all the time,
yeah,
this doesn't really trigger anything.
There needs to be something a little more. There needs to be, there's, you know what, I'll get to one of my biggest, there needs to be a big threat. There needs to be a big bad, a big threat, something you're worried about overall. And you know what, this movie doesn't have one.
Charlie once again says that this is all her fault as she's a monster. She says she hates living like this as they made her this way and she hates them for it. And then as she's saying this, her mom's arms get caught on fire. All right, we've been shooting a lot of criticism this film's way, and God forbid it deserves it. One thing I will say I like about what they do here is the fact that her mom's arms get caught on fire and we see the after effects of it. In 1984, we saw people get set on fire and we didn't really see them suffer from it. Later on, we're going to see Andy wrap this girl's arms in bandages and take them off very slowly, and it looks like it hurts. It looks like it burns. So at least we're seeing the after effects of what Charlie does.
Yeah, I think it's important to see that there's some consequences to it other than just sticking it in some water and everything's okay. Because it should feel like if she does something later, she's going to hurt somebody. But I don't know. It's good, but it doesn't matter later. But yeah, I like it at this part. And I feel for the dad, because here in a little bit, like he's got to be just forlorn. Like, what the hell do I do?
Mm-hmm. I mean, this is the best looking piece in the movie, but I also don't like how nothing she does after this is as startlingly real. I never feel like people are, in a metaphysical sense, like capable of being hurt with her pyrokinesis. To Adam's point, if they just dump their head in water, their burns will go away.
We cut to the shop, who have their eyes right on the school where the incident took place, and then we get introduced to Rainbird. But after George C. Scott and Malcolm McDowell played this character, nice to see them actually get a Native American here.
Yeah, there is no possible way in today's day and age you do a character named Rainbird without getting an actual native to do this role. There is no possible way. So I'm glad they did. It'd be nice if they got one that could act, but hey, at least you check that box that is required in today's society.
I just want to axe this entirely or come up with a new big bad, to Adam's point. This should have at least local destruction possibility. Not talking like Galactus coming down, but it should be more than just one bounty hunter.
One thing I do like what they do with this character is the fact that they give him powers as well. He is a master sharpshooter, and I do like that.
Yeah, they made him freaking Bullseye.
Pretty much. One thing I hate about what they do with this character is the uncomfortableness that came with the character the first time we saw him, where he wanted to get close to Charlie because he wanted to feel what it felt like when he actually kills her by his hands. All of that goes out the window because we see him interact with Charlie in the first act of this film. And I feel it takes away a lot of that evil dynamic that we saw the first time. This character is kind of here just to be here. He is here so that people can point to him and say, look, they finally got a Native American for a Native American role. Other than that, he serves zero purpose in this. And don't even get me started on the final fucking scene of this movie, which I'll get to when we get to it. Also, what they do, we have Hollister as a woman. Last time, this character was played by Martin Sheen, and we all said it wasn't very good in that. Here is Gloria Rubin, and Adam, you should be pretty familiar with this character. You were a big ER fan, weren't you?
Was, and I think she's as fine as anybody else in this. It's a role.
Yeah, I think if you're going to go this route, you got to go for like a Viola Davis, right? Matt, you got to get somebody with a little bit more power behind their voice.
Yeah, or Octavia Spencer or somebody, because I also hate when they do this in movies where it's just, we're going to do a gender flip just because.
Yeah.
Like, there's no incremental reason behind it. It's just, oh, we'll do it because between that and, hey, we cast an actual Native American as Rainbird, we're trying to get, instead of DSI, it should be DEI.
Yeah, and the other problem is, both those actresses you mentioned, their salaries probably exceed the budget of this entire film, so I don't think you could get any of those. But Hollister is asking Rainbird to commit one more hit, as she is now the new guard of DSI. She reveals the target, and she says that this target needs to be brought back alive. We see Vicky in complete pain from her burns as Andy wraps them up, as I mentioned earlier. She says that she could have pushed her, and this is what happens when you stuff it down. So she's coming after Andy here. We see Vicky have a hard time grabbing her suitcase as she looks over and hears a knock on her door. She opens it and sees a police officer following up on a call from earlier in the night. Vicky says it was a grease fire and sends the officer on her way. She grabs a rabbit's foot and sees Rainbird in the house. He asks where they went, and he goes on about how the shop needed lab rats before they got to them. He starts stalking Vicky through the house, and she asks him how he could work for them. She sends some shrapnel his way before he grabs her. She says that when you see her, you will understand. So we're having Rainbird kill the mom here. Interesting plot point.
I don't mind this change. I think it's an okay place to go with it. You know what? I got a note in here. It's Max Katie Rainbird.
Oh, shit.
See, that's who they make this character throughout this film. If you're going to do something to kill her off, I mean, it makes him indebted. It shows something else. I think this is one of those changes that at least makes some sense. Whether or not I like it completely, I could at least understand what they were doing here.
Yeah, I'm not going to call it like a great change, but it at least adds some, I don't know, motive.
We cut to Charlie and Andy in the car as Charlie asks if her mom will forgive her. Andy says that she'll forgive her no matter what as they exit the car and enter the house. Charlie says it feels weird in there as they walk further and find Rainbird in the house with Charlie on his hand. Andy tries pushing him as Charlie causes heat to overtake the house and Vicky falls out of the closet. The house is now on fire as the fire alarm is going off and they run out. We cut to Hollister visiting Juan List, played by Kurtwood Smith. And they're talking about her new plan. Speaking of plans, now, Kurtwood Smith is here, what, for two scenes, maybe? I think
One and a half.
I think he was put here to be a part of a series of films. I think this is setting up a sequel, as we see Hollister and Juan List here. But, my God, I mean, Matt, can you waste Kurtwood Smith anymore?
Yeah, and I think they took the term bitches leave to the theaters because nobody went to go see this.
Everybody else in this is kind of hit forgettable. It's not doing anything that I need.
I think when the rights for this came up, Jason Blum said, I'll buy that for a dollar.
Like, I get the impetus as to why you would make this, but then make it.
I was screaming at my TV, do something.
Yeah, we're about at the halfway point here and nothing is happening.
Like, this feels like a TV miniseries that they condensed into 90 minutes.
For sure.
Because this whole movie feels like this part with Kurtwood Smith would be a full episode.
This movie is about 20 minutes shorter than the first film, and my God, it actually feels 20 minutes longer, doesn't it?
I could not wait for this to end.
Yeah. We see Charlie trying to control her powers as her dad dreams of Vicky. Charlie then spots a cat who hisses and scratches her, and she does the only sensible thing, which is set it on fire. Guys, when we did Marvel, we talked about Kingsman. Would they kill the dog? Would they get on the audience's side if we see them kill a dog? Why are we seeing our main character here kill a cat?
Yeah, and it's for what you said earlier. We need to be scared of her anytime she's going to go Phoenix throughout the rest of this film. So we're supposed to think that she's scary. This doesn't do that. I should either be scared about her or I should feel for her. And I don't feel either. With this, and that's too bad because I got to do one or the other. I don't empathize or sympathize.
Yeah, I don't feel much in the way of anything towards this character despite what she does, and I think that's kind of a damning thing for me to say about the protagonist.
We see Hollister telling Juan List that she wants to help Charlie and she wants Juan List to come back to work. Juan List talks about what the fear of Charlie must feel like and that Charlie's power is in its infancy. The more she grows, the more dangerous she will get. Hollister says that they're not wanting to clone her, they just want to understand her. And then Wallace replies that we need to terminate the girl or she will destroy us all. So he's setting us up again. I think this is for future movies.
Yeah, you need to explain the why with the urgency if she's only 12. Yes. Why now? And why, I know we didn't start the fire, I made that joke last time. Why do you go to extremes with this?
Meanwhile, Andy and Charlie, they bury the cat and pray for its happiness. As well as the blessing of Vicky.
The cat doesn't have to beg for forgiveness.
I know.
She's the one who's going to hell for killing the cat.
And I love how when she burns it initially, that cat is 3/4 burned and it's still alive. Andy's like, you need to finish the job. I thought it was already finished. It's 3/4 burned.
Just bury it in the pet cemetery.
There you go. to get to a future property.
And I do think that is where they're trying to get with it. That's what they're trying to have some substance, is that what she's doing has repercussions, and she's got to see those all the way through because of what she did to this cat. She can't leave it tortured. She's got to finish killing it once she started.
Good call.
Like, I get it. It's not done well, but I get it.
Andy says that Charlie's mom wanted to teach her to use her power for good, and Charlie reveals when she does it, it does feel kind of good. They start hitchhiking, and Andy says that they're not using the car because they're being searched for, and if they find them, they'll study her like the frog from earlier. We then see good old Irv. He stops for Andy and Charlie. Now, this is from the book, obviously, although this character is much different than we saw before because he's just an old angry drunk. He says that he can't go to Boston, but Andy offers $100 for them to do so, and this was a little callback to that original film. On the way, Irv offers for them to come to the house for a nice home-cooked meal. So Charlie wants to play with the chickens. As Andy goes inside the house, we see Charlie sense something as Irv calls his wife to the kitchen and they have a beer together. Andy says that he's a life coach. Meanwhile, Charlie walks to the barn and peeks inside before falling in and finding Essie. So we're, again, changing the whole dynamic here. Instead of this old nice couple that takes Charlie in at the end, now we're seeing this guy just kind of hold his wife in a vegetative state because he feels guilty for the car accident that almost took their lives. Man, this is a fucking mess, right?
I don't know where this is leading. And all of these freaking detours, I know they're not going to be of any consequence in the final act. So I feel like this movie's just wasting my time.
I'm a little intrigued with this just because it's at least giving me something different here. But I don't know what it's doing. So I'm like, okay, where's it going to go? But then I have a big, big, big problem with what we get here. Because okay, previous film, we made a lot of jokes and, you know, everything. You know, ha ha, she's Jean Grey. She's this and that. Well, guess what this film does? This one actually literalizes it by giving her both their powers. Mm-hmm. She's got the telepathy and she's got the pyrokinesis. And doing more was not the best idea.
Irv gets upset about Charlie disturbing Essie before apologizing for his behavior. Irv then introduces them to Essie, and he says that she died when someone ran a red light. He then tells them that they can stay as he's enjoying their company. Charlie says that she'll only hurt bad people and that she will make them hurt if they come after them. Andy talks about how they discovered how Charlie had her powers and how he could sense where she was. Guys, how do we feel about the Efren neck cock every time he's about ready to do something?
Oh, he's doing the Clooney head tilt.
Yes. We're hearing how Andy hurt the men who took her. He tells Charlie that when she hurts people, she's not just hurting them, she's hurting the people around them. And he makes her promise that she won't use her gifts to hurt people. We're then hearing newscasts of how Andy is suspected of murdering his wife and taking their 11-year-old daughter. This, of course, reaches Irv. Andy tells him that he did not kill his wife or kidnap his daughter. He swears he's trying to protect her as he knocks Irv down. Charlie says that she knows how Essie and Justin died. She then tells him that she forgives Irv for what he did because it was an accident. So apparently, Charlie has a shrine here, right?
Yeah, and somewhere that cat is going, God damn you, where was that for me?
Exactly. The police that Irv called, out of overreaction, they show up. Irv tells him to hide as the police come to the door. Irv walks out and says that he's sorry because he was mistaken. He approaches the cops and talks about a documentary he saw as Charlie starts losing control. As she says, someone's here. Now, a couple weeks ago, we talked about how them blow-drying Drew Barrymore's hair meant we knew that something was coming. They kind of do that with the Zac Efron neck cock, as I mentioned earlier, but I don't know.
It's spider sense.
Yeah, spider sense.
I don't feel scared of her whatsoever. There's some times where I feel a little empathy for her and stuff, but who am I scared about or for? I'm hoping she's going to do bad things to bad people, but we don't even really get that. So this movie doesn't know the kind of movie it wants to be. If it's a drama with her going through this, make it that. If it's a horror movie because you put King's name on it, make it that. But instead, this is a Zac Efron joint. So, whatever that is.
Yeah, this movie has an identity crisis in the worst way.
I remember in the lead up to this, Keith Thomas was in an interview saying that they want to make it more horror driven because they felt that the way the original book was, the way the original story was, it was more science fiction. But I'm not even getting that. I guess that's supposed to happen when she kills the cat. I don't know. But I'm not getting any of that. And we don't even get any of Charlie killing the scientist like she did in the first film. She's just kind of moseying around here, and it just doesn't make any sense. So Charlie says that he's going to search the property anyway before shots ring out, and we see that Rainbird is taking out all of these agents instead of Charlie setting them on fire like we saw the first film. She runs out to Irv's body as Rainbird approaches. Andy tells Charlie to run as he tries pushing Rainbird, but he sees her running and he says, "Clever girl."
Oh, God.
Before he takes Andy out with the butt of his gun. I guess he's impervious to Jedi mind tricks.
I don't want to talk about Star Wars anymore.
Okay. Some agents show up and we see some moving of a yellow lens in an eye. And they take Andy away. So this is how they get away from Andy's powers, right? They have these lenses in their eyes that keeps him from being able to push them.
It almost makes me... You should feel scared of the shop as they're coming about and doing these things.
For sure.
But you don't. Because everything is just an afterthought.
Well, they should be how Weapon X was treated in Logan. Right? Like, they experimenting on kids and you see just how awful they are.
Oh, man, that character is about as good an actress as we get here. We cut to Charlie running away in the woods as Rainbird is brought before Hollister, who calls him sloppy. Hollister tells him that he doesn't know how she feels as he calls Charlie his sister and mother, and that when she sees her, she will understand. Meanwhile, Charlie is having nightmares of Rainbird as she wakes up and mindfully searches for her dad. Speaking of which, he is woken up by Hollister, who tells him that there will be no more running. So we're not even getting any real experimentation here. We're just having Charlie be the one who hunts for her dad. None of the uncomfortableness of the first film, nothing even here except Charlie being the rescuer.
Which is fine. That doesn't fit in this movie, but what they're doing doesn't exactly fit in this movie either.
Hollister tells Andy that Rainbird believes he and his daughter have a sort of telepathy. Hollister then insists that Andy tell her where Charlie is, as the fact that she's on the run is dangerous for everybody. We then cut to Charlie, who's eating some berries and drinking some water from a creek as she starts sensing her dad. She puts out some fires she makes before setting some big ones and then telepathically tells her dad that she's coming for him. We then see her walking in a neighborhood as kids start circling her on bikes. They ask her if she bathes. As she tells them that she likes their bikes, one gets off his as another empties his pockets to her, and we cut to her riding one of their bikes to the coast. So we can't even be scared of her here. Here, she should be setting these boys on fire. But none of that. We just cut to her riding the bike as a result of it. God, this is fucking terribly done.
Somebody realized that it's a King movie, so let's get some adolescent bullies into this thing.
Well, I don't care if they do that. Just burn them. Do something to make us scared of this chick. They can't even do that right.
I'm kind of at a loss for words at this point, because they're like, oh, this is a Stephen King movie. What's the most blatant thing we can use that's a trope? Bullies. Got it. And it's inexcusable because they're out of the school.
Again, if you're going to show them, burn them. We even saw Carrie take one out on her bike, for God's sake. You're saying creepy Carrie. We don't even see any of that. We just see the driving away on this bike as if nothing happened. We see Charlie in a car getting access by terrifying an agent inside of it. She asks for his gun and then asks if there is a long-haired man before roasting him. I do like this makeup effect, and one thing this movie gets right, again, is showing the after effects of what happens when Charlie burns you. That's not something we got in the first film, as I mentioned earlier, but I like this effect of this guy being set on fire. Although when he's done, this guy does look like Two-Face.
He does, but I like this, and it calls back to her having to finish him, yes. You know, when she's done. This took it a little further than I thought they were willing to go. Happy to see it.
Charlie walks inside the building, and this is what's taking over, setting fire to a staple that we saw in that first film, right? Going through the hall of the shop. She finds Andy, saying that she got his message, and Andy says that it wasn't him, as Hollister shows up and says that she can protect them both if they go with her, as it is what her mom would have wanted. But Charlie insists that Hollister call a doctor as she tries controlling her power. Hollister says they make people better here, as she is a real-life superhero, and that she is very special. Oh boy. Hollister insists that they know how to handle her power as they made her. She then says that if Andy does one more push, it might kill him, as Andy insists that she has to burn everything down. So Andy's final act, boys, is sacrificing himself to tell her to burn everything down.
I do not see a moment where he could push hard enough to have her do this. In something like this, I still feel like that's a step too far, especially after the mother in that. You think that she would, of anything, because she knew about the damage to her mother, she would resist this and find a way to save them both. That's what you could have done. She goes full Carrie at this point, is able to reject this, but completely just destroy the rest of the shop.
Carrie set fire to a town. This chick is setting fire inside cement walls, and it means absolutely nothing.
It means they're running out of film.
Yeah, for sure.
This is as unconvincing as cardboard cutouts you find those cheap theme parks.
I was craving the Chloe Grace Moretz hand movements as she was moving cars and things in that Carrie remake from 2013. I mean, I was looking for something to be scared of this girl. I was looking for something to look at and say, you know what? That's the reason to remake this. But I'm not seeing any of that. I'm not feeling any of the drama here. I think all of this is just so fucking poorly conceived that at this point, I'm like, Matt, I'm wanting this 95 minutes to end. So Charlie sets Hollister, her dad, and the entire room on fire. She then puts her red hood up and makes her way through the facilities. Rainbird walks out of his holding cell as well, while Charlie is setting agent after agent on fire, including this scared woman named Gale. She screams and sets another set of agents on fire. Rainbird takes out a few agents of his own, who are in front of Charlie, before setting down his gun. She approaches him, before turning off the sprinklers and taking down her hood, and just simply walking past him. She walks outside the whole facility before setting it all on fire and then collapsing on the beach. Rainbird once again appears beside her as he offers his hand and picks her up. We see them walking along the beach as credits roll on Firestarter 2022. So the man who killed her mom is now her friend. God, this pissed me off. I had a
feeling that that was going to be where you, if you stuck around, you were going to lose it. That.
I was so pissed at this. It's like when we watched that Carrie remake from 2002 and we saw Carrie and Sue Snell just driving through the town and they're about ready to go to their next town and we're going to see an Incredible Hulk style. That's exactly what I'm feeling like they're trying to set up here. But my God, there was none of the menace that I felt. Even in that goddamn George C. Scott character, which was awful in that first film, as we mentioned, I'm feeling no menace. I'm feeling nothing. As Thomas just holds the camera at this Indian from below, reaching his hand down and picking her up, I was just fucking angry at this point, and I was so pissed that they took two characters that actually meant something as far as menace goes and turned it into this. Matt, what did you feel at the end of this? Besides the fact that it was ending, did you feel anything here?
Other than anger? Because I was with you where I'm like, this movie has a very narrow view of forgiveness where, oh yeah, this guy killed her mother and they might as well be going out for hot dogs after this, but she burns a cat alive. This movie's borderline incompetent with what it's trying to do. And the only reason it's not is because the camera's in focus, but oh my God, is this movie bad?
How bad is it? Scale of 1 to 10, what do we give Firestarter 2022? Adam, unleash, sir.
Let the fire out. Go away, go away, go away. It's amazing how the same studio, I guess if you want a production company, they made something like Hollow Man, made this. Well, you know what? This is a Hollow movie. There's nothing here. Why get the rights to it? I hope it was a dollar, baby. I hope that's all he paid. This thing is just lifeless. There's no there. Why remake this and make it this empty of a film? Tell you what, Zac Efron is decent. There you go. There's your compliment on the film. Put that on the poster. Zac Efron is decent. Unfortunately, the rest of this film isn't. You know what? John Carpenter's not horrible. That's all you get out of this. It's a simple story that you should have to work hard to screw up. It really is. The girl's got powers because her mom and dad did medical experiments, and they're on the run. It should be pretty fucking easy. So to screw it up and make just a listless movie that you kind of wish you could run it 1.5 or 2 times to get through it, it's a shame. This thing is soulless. The effects are bad. The emotion is missing throughout the entire thing. There's no there to this. Firestarter, this thing couldn't spark if you fronted it a lighter. The spark is out of this. I don't want another one. Don't try to do this again. It's a waste of time. It's a 3. No, I'll be nice. I'll give it a 4. It was in focus. I'll give it a 4. There's no reason to watch this. And to Matt's point at the very beginning of this, this shows that Blumhouse sometimes is like an all or nothing. It has a hit or it has a dud. and that this actually kind of scraped by some money blows my mind, because this feels like a direct-to-streaming movie.
All right, so 4 from Mr. Bunch. Matt, what about you?
I'm going to go with his original score, because when this was done, I thought of... You guys have seen A History of Violence, right?
Yeah.
There's that part at the end where William Hurt goes, "How do you fuck that up?" That's how I felt watching this. And I think I even said something similar, because I made Christian watch this with me. Poor bastard. This was a slog. The only reason it's not like getting a 2 or a 1 is because I wasn't offended in terms of having bad undertones or misogyny, you know, those kinds of things. But the last part of this, the resolution, is, my God, one of the biggest misfires I have seen in a movie in a long time. And it's so bad that even Stephen King would be like, that's a terrible end. So for that, I'm going to give this a 3.
A 3 from Goudreau. All right, let the King fan talk. Why do I set myself up for failure? When I saw that this was being developed, and I saw the team behind it, even before I knew who Keith Thomas was, I was thinking, God, I'm kind of looking forward to that. Trailer comes out, I'm thinking, wow, Zac Efron, I think he can sink his teeth into this role. I think this girl looks menacing enough. I want to see this. And then, poor Jen, like Matt, I set my lover down to watch this with me, and I wanted to turn it off, not even halfway through. That first film did the book word by word, sentence by sentence, page by page. It is a direct adaptation that should be known as a translation from page to screen, because, as I mentioned in that podcast, that movie is almost word for word from the book. They go so far off script here that I don't even recognize these characters. I don't even recognize this property. I don't know what they're doing. It goes way off kilter. And by the end, as she's walking through the woods and I see where they're going with it, I'm thinking, oh, she's going to come rescue her dad. I don't care. Gloria Rubin, bad miscast. Charlie, I think she tries, but she's not very good either. And Zac Efron, he is, as somebody mentioned earlier, he's sleepwalking through this. This, just given the disappointment, I want to go one lower than that. I'll give this a 2. I was so fucking disappointed in what this came out as that I'm hoping Stephen King can gather these rights, and much like Sean Cunningham did with Friday the 13th, much like Wes Craven's ears have done with Nightmare on Elm Street, to scoop these rights up and not even take the checks anymore. You're rich enough, dude. Just take it and do something good with it, even if it's just to preserve what integrity you have left. Because this well has been milked dry between this, that TV fucking movie that I don't know if we can ever track down, and that first film, which was okay. This took it to new lows, and God, was I disappointed in this. Just terrible film. 2 out of 10. If you have seen it, you know how bad it is. If you haven't seen it, don't even bother. Hell, if you're that curious about this story, which, by the way, I didn't feel the book was that good to begin with, then just fucking watch that first movie. You'll get your fill. This is bad. 2 out of 10 for Firestarter. Next week, we get another movie that's going to be remade, although we're going to get to watch it before we see any trailers or anything. We are getting Cujo next week, a movie that is very well liked amongst a lot of King fans. Matt, what are you expecting next week when we talk about that Rabbit St. Bernard Cujo?
It's been a long time since I've seen it. I mean, I remember premise, and I remember the part of the barn at the end, but that's really it.
So you're not expecting anything?
No, I don't know what to expect, because it's been so long.
All right. So, Adam, another ET alum, is going to come back next week when we talk about Cujo. What are you expecting next week?
I'm expecting me to see a movie I've never seen before.
Oh, wow. You've never seen Cujo, huh?
No, but I feel I have, because I think every time they do clips for anything, for any type of award shows, somehow I see a freaking rabid Cujo. So, I don't know. Do they stay in a car the whole movie with a rabid dog? I have no idea what I'm going to see. So, it'll be a new experience for me. We'll see how it goes. But I don't know how a rabid dog justifies a feature-length film. So, God, I hope I'm surprised.
I think you will be. There's a lot to discuss with next week's film in regards to where King was at that time, where Stephen King was when he wrote that book, where he was when that movie was released, and the changes they made to that, which are pretty drastic from what I remember. So there are a lot of places to go next week when we get to Cujo. But until next week, we will put Firestarter on the back burner. It is done. Hopefully Blumhouse knows the failure this movie was and doesn't come out with another one. If he does, we'll be there. But God, set this on fire. We'll never see Firestarter again. But until next week, when we get to Cujo, Liar Liar, Podcast on Fire. Thank you, boys.
Did we get the audio?
We got it.
We did!
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
Now, you've got to learn to control that. You got to try real hard.
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
What have you done to my father?
He's resting, and he's fine, just like you. And he knows you're all right, and he sends his love. And he wants you to cooperate with us.
You're a liar!
Now, what kind of talk is that from a nice little girl like you?
Go to hell!
Please visit and check out our Percolated Media Facebook page. To get an advance look at what the boys will be reviewing that week, as well as other things such as Matt and Garrett's wrestling podcast, what the site has in store for the future, some periodically done written reviews, and so much more. Message us, give us your thoughts, visit and share. We greatly appreciate interacting with you, our listeners. And if you would be so kind, please take a moment and give us a positive review and rating on your podcast platform of choice.
Holy Christ, I knew something was going to happen, but I had no idea.
It truly helps others find and discover our podcasts.
We do great things. We make things better here. We make people better. We make them stronger people like you.
Check out the Percolated Media Archives, as we have tons of franchise reviews, including the Planet of the Apes franchise, the Mad Max movies,
the Exorcist films, movies of the Alien franchise,
Jurassic Park, and so many more.
What more do you want from us? Why can't you just let us go?
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, Adam, and Nathan.
The world out there, they don't know how to handle your power.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
I give you my real word.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
I know you're tired. You're not quite sure where you are or why you're here. So I just want to ease your mind, Joe.
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network. And all opinions expressed on the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental.
No one wants to hurt you or your daddy.
You liar! You're supposed to kill him, and I know it.
I'd advise you to do what my daughter says. I mean, you know why she's wanted.
This podcast is for entertainment purposes, and all clips, music, and audio cues are used as such.
You and me are going to be pals.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is a Percolated Media production. All rights reserved, and no copyright infringement is intended.
You're here because I'm very interested in this ability that you have.
Pyrokinesis.
Yes. All of us here are interested in that, and we want to see how far you can take it.
Elizabeth Olsen is like, nope, there's no way, there's no pot. I'm absolutely, absolutely, absolutely not in this movie. So she's in it. Yeah.
All right, you nerds. You ready?
Yeah, says the guy who made us watch this movie again.
Sometimes you get something like The Invisible Man, which is great. And then other times they'll do
Wolfman
sequels to their original movies, like Sinister 2, I thought was just dog shit. So I never know what I'm going to get.
You see Wolfman, by the way?
I did, and I was very let down.
Oh, so bad. I agree with that.
One, I can't stand High School Musical, but I know it. I remember it. Okay, I was at Disney when they did the parades. The
Wildcats. I was in school when those came out, if that makes you feel any better.
Christ.
No, it doesn't.
But I was not in high school. Because when did the first one come out?
No 2000, idea.
2006, so I would have been 13.
Jesus.
Wow.
Oh, God, I feel like Matt Damon at the end of
Saving Ryan.
Yes. But Zac Efron.
She calls Charlie's name as the door bangs and fire just explodes out of it. Again, none of this is in the book. This is all written for the film.
I mean, this is freaking Scott's laser beams going off in Apocalypse.
I thought you were going to say
it's the exact same thing.
I thought you were going to say Scott Howard in Teen Wolf when he goes in the bathroom and he has werewolf hands, but I guess
we're going. I've never seen Teen Wolf.
Really? Ooh. Future retrospective.
Teen Wolf 2 I've seen about 10 times.
Which one?
Teen Wolf 2 I've seen about 10 times.
Really? You haven't seen the first Teen Wolf, but you've seen Teen Wolf 2?
Yeah, it's sort of like I had this thing like where as a kid I never saw the original Grease, but I loved Grease 2.
Grease 2 is better.
Charlie walks out and Andy says that she just needs to shove it down and keep it hidden. And then we get to every kid's worst nightmare, fucking dodgeball.
Nowadays, they don't even do this in schools. They've really kind of taken dodgeball out of the curriculum.
They have. Adam, remember those red balls just coming right at your fucking face? God.
I can remember the smell and I can still hear the clang.
I know. The ginger takes her out.
It's a 3. No, I'll be nice. I'll give it a 4. It was in focus. I'll give it a 4. There's no reason to watch this. And to Matt's point at the very beginning of this, this shows that Blumhouse sometimes is like an all or nothing. It has a hit or it has a dud. And that this actually kind of scraped by some money blows my mind, because this feels like a direct-to-streaming movie.
All right, so a 3 from Mr. Bunch.
No, he said 4.
Oh, that's right. 4, sorry. All right, so 4 from Mr. Bunch.
Handsome.